Good morning, church. I am thankful for Ty this morning. I tell you that we are, you know, we'll miss Tommy somewhat while he's out recovering with his voice, but we are so thankful to have Ty filling us in and doing just a great job on that. And I'm thankful, Ty, because I've done both before. Lead singing and preach, and it can get a little confusing at times, and people more than that really get tired of seeing me up here, and you do a great job, so I'm really thankful for you this morning. I told you last week that we were going to have applications for small groups, and I hate to say applications. If you want to be in a small group, you're in a small group. Most of you. But we have these up here, and we want to encourage you and your families to be a part of a small group. If you are interested in being a part of a small group, I'm going to just leave these applications up on the front row. If you're interested in leading a small group, I wish you'd come and talk to me, and we'll try to work it out and see if we can and do that. And we have some new material this year. We're going to be using the Right Now Media, the program that we talked about that you can download onto your phones and onto your laptops or onto your computers. And you can stream all these great Christian Bible studies and lessons. And there's small group studies on there. We'll be utilizing their material this year, lining up some studies for everybody. I think it's going to be really, really effective. I'm thankful this morning Zach prayed for me and for my family. But Zach, I got to tell you, it threw me for a loop when you prayed for Dustin and Rebecca and Jonathan and Heather. Because I was thinking, my daughter's name is not Heather. That was the first thought that went through my mind. My daughter's name is Addison, unless you go to school with her, in which case her name is Mariana. But today is her 15th birthday. She is so excited about it. I took this picture this morning. So we're really excited about that and really excited to teach her to drive and all that. I don't know about you, but as my kids have gotten older and as they continue to get older, I become increasingly concerned about the world that they're inheriting from us, right? The world has changed. Think back just 30 years. How much has the world changed in the last 30 years? And 30 years is about the time I graduated from high school. And I think about just how much the world has changed in that time. How much will it change in 50 years? What kind of world will that be? What kind of challenges and obstacles are they going to face that you and I have not even imagined yet? What kind of mess will we leave behind for them to deal with? And what claims will our culture make on them, the young ones, that we've never had to face? Right now, we deal with claims today that you 30 or 50 years before us never had to deal with. But I have to confess that one of my concerns has to do with claims of allegiance. And there are numerous battles on that front, competitions for our allegiance, for their allegiance. But I specifically think about the dual claim that we face and that our kids will face in the future between church and state. Now, we haven't always thought of this as a dual claim. In fact, there was a time in our nation's history we thought this was almost one and the same. Not one and the same way that maybe Russia had a national church. They had the Russian Orthodox Church, or Italy had Roman Catholicism was the official religion, and there have been official state churches, right? The Church of England being the one that we came out of when we immigrated over to America out of that background. But even in our own history, there's been almost this idea that these were one and the same. But from the very beginnings of Christianity, even in the years leading up to Jesus coming, this has been a hot button issue for the people of God. Who gets to claim our allegiance? Now, we had a lesson on the separation of church and state back when we were studying through the Gospel of Luke, and we looked at that, and it was really an interesting study. This is not a look at the separation between church and state. This morning, we want to talk about our allegiances to church and or state? Who gets to claim our allegiance? And one of the passages we tend to turn to when we think about this question comes from the Gospel of Mark, the Gospel we've been studying through. And it's one of Mark's controversy stories near the very end of Jesus' life, before he's arrested and tried and ultimately crucified. It's one of those stories. And at the heart of this story is a quote that has been cited numerous times by people on both sides, or actually there's three or four different interpretations, but they use it as a proof text for arguing a few different sides. But when we dig just a little deeper, when we kind of peek behind the scenes, we discover that there is a lot more going on in this story beneath the surface. These are things I want to try to bring to the forefront this morning so that we can understand it just a little bit better. My prayer is also that we will discover the principle that can guide us as you and I, we try to make the very best decisions, not just for ourselves today, but for our kids going into the future, the very best decisions we can in this arena of our allegiance. It comes from Mark chapter 12, beginning at verse 13. We read this. Later, they sent some of the Pharisees and Herodians to Jesus. Now, the they there, you have to understand, it's going back to the story, the previous story and the story before that. The they is the rulers of the Sanhedrin. You got the chief priests and the scribes and the elders. That's who Jesus has sort of been going back and forth with here the last few stories. They, chief priests, scribes, and elders, sent some of the Pharisees and Herodians. Now, the Herodians were also with them on the Sanhedrin. The Pharisees were very influential in that area as well. These were all the people in power. Okay, now they're all together, these big five. They sent some of the Pharisees and Herodians to Jesus to catch him in his words. And they came to him and they said, "Teacher, we know that you are a man of integrity. You aren't swayed by others because you pay no attention to who they are, but you teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. Is it right, therefore, is it right to pay the imperial tax to Caesar or not? Should we pay or shouldn't we?" Now, at this point, we got to understand what's going on here, because this sounds almost like if you came to me and said, "Should I pay my taxes to the U.S. government?" It's, you know, April 15th is coming up, you think, and should I pay my taxes, and is that a right thing to do? You may not agree with everything the U.S. government does with your tax dollars. And so we kind of interpret it in light of that, but that's not exactly what's going on here. At the time of Jesus, the Jews in Judea had to pay essentially three main types of tax. You've got landed property tax. In other words, if you owned some land, you paid taxes on that. You had personal property tax. So even if you didn't own land, you paid taxes on what you owned. Maybe you had cattle, or maybe you had a house that you had goods in, whatever. You paid this personal property tax. And then you also had the indirect imperial taxes, like customs, if you're shipping things here and there or selling goods, right? You had customs. And these three taxes were a heavy tax burden. It was hard to pay those, but that's not the issue here, whether or not it's right to pay because it's a lot of taxes. The issue of the day, the burning question of the day, was this: is it right for the people of God to pay tribute to Caesar? Is it right for the people of God to pay tribute to Caesar? Now, just a few years prior to this, in 6 AD, back when Jesus was just a kid, right? There was this Judas the Galilean. Judas the Galilean, he led an uprising against Rome. He rallied all the peasants, the poor people in the countryside, think Nazarene. He rallies these people, teaching that it was wrong for the people of God to pay tribute to the Romans. Now, this wasn't the first time they had to pay tribute. This is not their first overlord they've had. But when Rome came in with their sweeping changes and their brutal mentality, they demanded a tribute from every individual, every male anyway, in Judea. And it was essentially saying, we're going to be loyal to Rome, right? And this revolt was quashed by Rome just immediately. I mean, Rome came in. They crucified dozens of people right along the roadsides there in Galilee. And then later, in 70 AD, just a few years after Jesus dies, this same idea is part of the reason for their uprising, this time of most of the nation, against their Roman overlords. So in Jesus' day, paying this tribute to Rome was a revolting idea, right? You're paying Rome, who has this well-earned reputation for quashing rebellions with enthusiasm, like over-enthusiasm. And the vast majority of the people just sort of reluctantly were paying this tax, because refusal to pay this tax was rebellion. That's the flip side. If you don't want to pay the tax because you're paying this pagan Roman emperor to do terrible things with your money, he's saying you're loyal to him, and if you don't pay it, it's rebellion. And Rome puts down rebellions, remember, with enthusiasm. So the vast majority of the people just reluctantly resigned themselves. I don't want to do it, but I've got to do it. I don't think as a people of God that I should do it, because I don't think this is the right thing, but I have to do it so that I don't get me and my family killed and our property taken. That's the vast majority of people, except for a very few special groups. There were a few groups that actually benefited from this tax because Rome allowed them to stay in power. Groups like the chief priests and the scribes and the Herodians and the elders and the Pharisees, the people who made the ruling decision, they benefited from it. Because as long as everybody was loyal to Rome, then Rome kept all the people who were in power in place. Does that make sense? As long as things are flowing smoothly for Rome, Rome's not going to come in and say, no, 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 we're going to make all the decisions now. Everybody out. Everybody to the kids' table. Rome's not going to do that as long as things are going smoothly. So the people who have some measure of power, like the chief priests and the Sadducees and the Pharisees, right, they actually benefited from the temple tax. I mean, from the tribute tax. They didn't want anything to change. They liked the status quo because it kept them in power. They knew that in Jewish religious terms, payment of the tribute was wrong. They knew it. But they happily lived with it because of the benefits they received from keeping everything the same. So here they come to Jesus, this group, the people in power. And they come to Jesus and they try to butter him up, and they got this flattery. You are a man of integrity. You teach the way of God. You teach the truth. Everybody knows that. That's why we respect you so much. What do you think about this issue? And then they're thinking, either way Jesus answers, we've got him. If he says that it's right to pay the tribute to Caesar, then all the common people are going to say, this guy's a phony. He's not really from God. If he says it's wrong to pay the tribute to Caesar, then they can turn him over to their Roman overlords and say, this guy's starting a rebellion. They've got him either way. They've got him over a barrel with this really tricky question. But Jesus sees this question for what it is. It's a trap. And he sees his questioners for what they are. Hypocrites. So this is what Jesus does. Jesus knew their hypocrisy. Why are you trying to trap me? He asked. Bring me a denarius and let me look at it. And they brought him a coin. They asked him, whose image is this? He asked them, whose image is this? And whose inscription is on this coin, right? Caesar's, they replied. Then Jesus said to them, give to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and give to God the things that are God's. And they were amazed at him. It's a really interesting thing. You may have noticed as we've gone through Mark's gospel, these groups of people at different times in different places, different gatherings of these groups, have come to Jesus and they've asked him all sorts of questions. Now, sometimes they'll ask him a direct question. He'll give them a direct answer. But when they ask him a trap question, a question they're trying to trip him up with, a question like this, Jesus never, ever, ever gives a direct answer. He never gives an explicit answer. He may answer it with a question. He may say something that leaves them wondering. He may tell them a story, but he never answers the question directly when they're trying to trap him. So here, Jesus knows they're trying to trap him. And Jesus asks them, he says, just bring me one of those coins. And this was the coin he was talking about. This is this is Emperor Tiberius that's on this particular. Every Roman emperor, when he becomes emperor, has his face and his inscription put on the coin. And this is would have been the Roman emperor when Jesus, about this time in his ministry, it would have been the current one. You could use a former one as well. But this would have been the Roman Emperor Tiberius. So Jesus says, bring me this. This was the coin you had to pay with, a Roman denarius. And it was a silver coin. It was minted in Rome with the image of the emperor and with his inscription on it. So in essence, this coin carried with it the emperor's claim of authority over its users, as well as their service as his subjects. If you use this coin, you are acknowledging this guy's in charge. If you carried and used this coin, you were in essence saying, I am loyal to Caesar. And Rome knows this, right? They prohibit the Galileans from printing, or the Judeans from printing any coins. They can't print any coins except for the little bitty, like the copper coins, the cheap coins. And if that's all you've got, eventually you're going to want a bigger denomination of money. And they think eventually you'll have to use our coins and be loyal to our emperor. So all you can print is pennies, essentially, right? And so they do that, and then they impose a tax where you have to use one of their coins. This tax was specifically imposed on the Jewish people for just this purpose. It has been this particular region of the Roman Empire has been a hotbed from the very beginning. They're like, we've got to get these people under our thumb. We need to do something to make sure they know who's in charge on an ongoing basis. We will make them use our coin to acknowledge this. So when Jesus says to his questioners, all right, give me one of these coins. And they're like, oh, I got one right here. And they bring it to him. He's already made them acknowledge their hypocrisy. Right? They're saying, we don't know if it's right for the people of God to be paying this tax to Caesar. And Jesus says, all right, give me a coin. And then they pull out a coin, essentially saying, we're already loyal to Caesar. In front of everybody, in front of the crowd, they bring out the unpopular coin. Jesus makes them known for the hypocrites they are. And then Jesus says, give to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, give to God the things that are God's. And some have used this quote to say, therefore there are two kingdoms, right? You got the kingdom of the state, and you got the kingdom of God. But that's not exactly what's going on here. Because if that was the case, then when Jesus' trial came up, why would Jesus' accusers, these same people, the chief priests, scribes, Pharisees, Herodians, elders, they said Jesus forbade paying tribute to Caesar. Well, that doesn't look like what he's saying here. Why would they make that accusation openly? I mean, if they were lying, then there's all these people around who could have said, no, 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 Jesus didn't say that. But everybody understood this quote as saying Jesus meant not to pay the tax. Well, when Jesus says things, plural, you get the idea that there's more going on than just this tax. It's not just this imperial tax. Jesus is referencing the entire reign of the kingdom of God. And he says, give to Caesar the things or the services due to Caesar, and give to God the things or the services due to God. He's emphasizing God's claim over Israel. Every Jew who was listening to Jesus, everybody who heard him say this knew, everyone knew that God's claim over them was total. You could not have split allegiances between God and anything else. You could not. Even Jesus says this, no man can serve two masters. Remember? It's impossible. You can't have two masters. You cannot serve both one and the other. You'll come to love one and hate the other. You've got to only have one master. And every Jew knew this. You could only have one master, and that master must be God. And so here we are as Christians. We're looking back on this. We're trying to figure out, what did Jesus mean? Give to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and God the things that are God's. Jesus is essentially acknowledging the peasant's position. He's saying, look, you know and I know that God's claim over us is total. God owns us. God owns our land. God owns our personal property. He owns everything that we are, everything that we have, everything that we will have. It all belongs to God. They want to take some, and if you pay that to save your hide, I understand. But it's not lawful according to God's law. It is according to man's law. So as Christians, here we are, we're reading this, and we're trying to distinguish between the will of God and the will of the people. That's essentially what this is a question between. That's what a state is. A state, or a nation, or a city, or a community, they're all just people, right? We got the idea that these things exist apart from the people, like the United States would be anything with no people in it. Right? It's all just people, whether it's got 300 million or 5 million or 50,000 or 50. It's all just communities. It could just be a neighborhood. Your neighborhood may say, hey, we don't want you to tie up your dog to a tree in your front yard. That's against our neighborhood rules, right? And everybody just says, well, okay, we'll work together on this. And a city may say, hey, we want you to give us some money so that we can pave some roads and have some schools. And you're like, okay, I'm in on that. We'll do that together. It's all just people cooperating together for a common cause. That's all it is. And sometimes communities will choose things that are beneficial, that are the ways of God. They'll say things like, hey, we want to enforce not murdering people. And you're like, that's a great idea. I don't want to be murdered. Right? Sometimes they'll say things like, hey, we want to teach your children about how to read and write and science and math. And you're like, oh, that's a good thing. I want my kids to be educated. That's a great thing. Some people even disagree with that. But often we'll say, okay, well, we agree with that. But sometimes communities of people choose ways that are contrary to the ways of God. Every community. Every community ever has chosen at times things that are not God's ways. I'll bet you can think of laws right now, national laws, state laws, maybe even community laws, that you think that's not the way God would have it. Right? Can you think of some? I can think of some. And when that occurs, Jesus calls that the world. When a community chooses ways contrary to the ways of God, that is the world. And sometimes our community, sometimes our state, sometimes our nation will choose the ways of God. Sometimes they'll make laws that we think that's in harmony with the Word of God, with the law of God, with the will of God. That's a good thing. And sometimes it's not going to. But the question at heart this morning is where our allegiance lies. When those ways split, where do we go? When our community goes one way and God stays straight, which way do we go? And Jesus unequivocally says in this story that our first and foremost allegiance belongs to our Creator, our Master, our Redeemer, our Savior. It belongs to God. And this morning, we have to sort of suss out where we are. and look and say, where are my allegiances? Where is my first choice? When my family and God part ways, who do I go with? When my job and God part ways, who do I go with? When my community and God, or my state and God, or my nation and God, or the world and God, when they part ways, which way do I go? Because one way or another, we must make a choice, since we cannot serve two masters. And if this morning you need prayers of forgiveness, for healing, for strength, to publicly make a statement that I want to follow the ways of God, not just when it's easy, not just when it lines up with what the state or my family or my employer is doing. I want to follow the ways of God every time. And you need help with that. We want to walk with you in that path. And if this morning we can do that, won't you come as we stand and as we sing?
Have you been to Jesus?